Welcome, everyone. There's I'm not like the most, I lean more towards the lippish side of the spectrum than the Hasidic side of the spectrum. But there's a Hasidic story which always humored me, which has a good lesson to it, that there was this Hasidic Rebbe who was walking along with his students, and he saw a wagon driver. There's always a wagon driver in these stories. You know, there's like certain aspects that have to be in every single story, certain motifs. So the wagon driver was fixing his wagon and davening at the same time. So his students scoffed at him and they said, "Who is this guy? In middle of davening, he's working on fixing his wagon." And the Rebbe said, "No, in middle of the workday while he's fixing his wagon, he found some time to daven as well." So that's what I like to say. You know, if anyone needs to cook or do other things while attending a class, I consider it a privilege that you decide to entertain yourself by turning on one of our Shiur Medaguda Shalom in the meanwhile. So there you go. All right. So, Marina, I told you that one before, but I share it with the larger crowd. Obviously, if you have free time and are able to focus more, that works too. But get in whatever you can. That's what matters. All right. Welcome. Looks like we're joined. Looks like Toby and Jenny joined us now. Looks like Melissa on the phone. And that is Erwin Niederberg 789. He told me this morning. It's a good way to remember it. So looks like we have our crowd for this evening. Whoever joins us, join us. But we shall begin. So I'm just going to, I have a shtender over here, so it's like hard navigating to do things on my computer at the same time. But I'm going to share a link in the chat, which is just in case we lost the link from the first time to Safaria. I'm not going to share it every time. I can't promise that. But if anyone is following, wants a translation, it doesn't have an art scroll, look in the chat. There's an online translation to follow along. Okay. So before we jump into the Gemara, I wanted to share one brief idea that we didn't have time for last time we met, which was, does anyone remember why, if Adam Zomerman, they're accused of being Adam Zomerman, they conspired to testify, and they did testify falsely against somebody, that he committed negligent homicide, and he ought to be going to the city of refuge to live out most of his life as his punishment, to get an atonement for that sin. So the witnesses do not get sent into Gullus, we said. They don't go into exile. And the reason why, does anyone recall in the end of the day, why they don't go to Gullus, why they don't go into exile? What was the reason in the Gemara? Pop quiz. Jeremy.
Was it because the reason to send the person who actually was the perpetrator of the negligent homicide was almost to protect him from the family of the deceased, whereas the Adim Zomamin were not under that risk because they weren't involved in the killing.
Okay, very good. And I think my grandfather, he mentioned a similar idea last time we met. There was some discussion in the Gemara about a Kava Homer trying to figure out the rationale, but the rationale was a little bit difficult for reasons we won't rehash this moment. But in the end of the day, it really came down to a Gezeiras HaKasuv. It came down to a hermeneutical derivation from a verse. That's probably how art school translates it. It said, "Hu Yanus, he shall flee to the city of refuge." And we learn, "Hu Velo Zoman, he and not Im Zoman." But why do I need a separate exclusion? This is a question that I have a nice book here, Nitzotzei Shas. Rabbi Pinchas Hirschsprung went to the Brisker Rav. And he asked the Brisker Rav the following question: why do I need a separate exclusion for Adam Zoman, a separate dispensation when it comes to going to exile? Do you remember what the exclusion, what the dispensation was, why Adam Zoman don't get disqualified from kahuna, from being legitimate kohanim? We said, remember, lo v'lo lizaro. Only the witnesses could get punished for their deeds, but their children will not suffer for their deeds. So here's a great question. The Gemara that we will learn later on, I believe it's on Yud Amud Aleph, on 10a, so we still got a number of weeks till we reach there, but spoiler alert. What we learn in that Gemara later on is that when you, let's say, I, God forbid, accidentally kill somebody, I kill someone b'shogeg, inadvertently, and I have to go to a city of refuge, to an Ir Miklat, who goes along with me as well? Anyone know who else goes into exile?
The wife?
Not halakhically, though you would think if she's a faithful wife, she would follow him as well. My Rebbe. my rabbi has to follow me into exile too. Now, I don't think this means the rabbi of the shul, because, you know, I guess the second, you know, one guy has to go into exile, then a good shalom, you know, like you have 500 plus families or whatever it is, all of a sudden lose their rabbi. So that wouldn't work. But if someone has a Rebbe Mufak, who's their close teacher, their teacher is supposed to go into exile with them as well. I don't know the pragmatics. Like, if you have a rabbi of the community, is he leaving the whole community because of that one guy? Probably not. But that is the rule.
Why does the rabbi have to get punished?
What, Phyllis?
Why does the rabbi have to get punished for their...
We can talk about maybe she's done a better job teaching his student. Maybe the student just really needs the support, so he's being a good rabbi. We can talk about things like that. But the question is, great, why don't I just apply the same drusha, the same thing that we learned when it came to Eden Zoman for Kahuna? Just like we said, lo v'lo lezaro, only they get punished, not their children. Lo v'lo lerabo, they get punished. Their rabbi, their rebbe, shouldn't get punished along with them as well. So why do I need a separate verse to teach me that they don't go into exile? Who v'lo zomamin? I can just learn from the original drasha of lo v'lo lezaro, he and not children, the Eden Zomamin, and not their Rebbeim as well. That was the question that that this rabbi, I'm not familiar with him, Rav Pinchas Hirschsprung, asked the Brisker Rav. That was the question he asked. So this is like the Sefer Nitzotzei HaShatz. It has like kind of like cute questions and answers in here. So this is the answer that he gives. You'll tell me if you buy it, because he doesn't buy it, actually. The Brisker Rav, Yeshiva Arav Mi Brisk. The Brisker Rav answered, the Talmid Varavo Einam Shnei Dvar Nifran. It's very, very romantic, almost. That a teacher and his student are not considered two separate entities. Kim Davar Echad, but they are fused and considered one entity together. Guf Echad. Lechein Lo Shayech Le Midrash Halima Delo V'lo L'Rabo. You can't say lo v'lo l'rabo, the Edim, but not their Rebbeim, not their rabbis. Why? Shari rabo kolobovu kolobarabo. They are all considered as one joint entity, fused together. It almost sounds like something you'd say like in a romance novel, but this isn't between a man and woman. This is between a teacher and student. And therefore, you can't say the witnesses go to Golos, but not their Rebbeim. No, they are all included in the word lo. Lo encompasses not just the witnesses, but their teachers as well.
Got a problem.
I realize it could be really bad, because that would obligate me to go to Golos if that ever happens. But okay. That was the answer. So Hirschsprung was the chief rabbi in Montreal in the 70s and 80s. Okay, is this the same? Would he have had contact with the Brisker Rav in Israel? Henry, you're muted.
Yeah, he was born in Europe. He came to I think it's the same with Pinchas Hirschsprung. He came to Canada after the war, but depending on it.
You're right. You are correct. I it says here in his title, Hagon Hadir Rabbi Pinchas Hirschsprung Zatzal, Gon based in Montreal. All right.
Sorry for the trivia, but
that was great. No, I appreciate you bringing that in. It makes it so much more real. So you know what he answered? I didn't know his personality, but you'll see his personality here. Kishiyatsasi Mechedra Hirschsprung reports, when I left his room after I asked the Brisker Rav, Simagor Pinchas as Dvarav, he said, Amarti Tamidav, I remarked to his students, Shala Brisker Rav, Ki Teretze Matin Yoser Lomer La Admor Manik Chasidim. That answer would go better with an Admor or a Hasidic Rebbe. I don't really buy it. So it's more of like Rav Sobolovsky, one of my rabbis from YU, likes to say, it makes her a nice Saturday morning sermon. It doesn't necessarily hold up to the scrutiny of halachic discourse, but maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. The Brisker Rav said it, so he was a very serious halachist. I present that to all of my friends here this evening. All of you are welcome to consider it, whether you buy it or not. You can rely on the Brisker Rav, or you can follow Rav Hirschsprung's skepticism. Both are legitimate. Okay, that was an idea I just wanted to open up with that we didn't cover last time. And now hopefully anyone who is looking, trying to find the page of Gemara Gimel Aleph 3a, you found it in either your Gemara or on the website. So here we go. The context that we are picking up the Gemara in here is that, remember last time we talked about how the witnesses are not mishalim al pi atzman. Now, the witnesses, they get convicted in one beis din as Adam Zomimin, but that beis din didn't have time to actually sentence them for being Adam Zomimin. And then they run to a second court and they admit to the crime they committed. The second court will not hold them accountable because they, being Adam Zomimin, being charged as Adam Zomimin, is a knas. It's a penalty. And when someone admits to a penalty in court, you absolve yourself from the penalty. So if I stole $100 from you, I go to court and I admit to it, I pay the principal $100 back. But if I did not admit to the crime and two witnesses convict me of theft, then I pay kafel, I pay twice the amount. The additional $100 is a penalty. So if I admit to a penalty, I'm putter. That's the principle we learned last time. Just keep that in mind because it's going to be relevant in this next passage of the Gemara. But other than that, for all intents and purposes, this is a separate section of Gemara now. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Out of nowhere, out of the blue, a conversation begins. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav. This is two lines from the top. Eid Zomeim Mishayin Lefi Chelko. A witness, an Eid Zomeim pays based on his portion, meaning if two witnesses, they falsely accuse someone of owing $200, and then they become Adam Zomimin, one witness pays $100, the other witness pays the other $100. That's what Rabbi Yehuda seems to be saying. My Mishayin Lefi Chelko, Elim Adahai Mishayin Palaga, Vahai Mishayin Palaga. If we understand Rabbi Yehuda's statement to be telling us that the witnesses split the amount of money that they now owe the defendant, Tanina, why do I need an Amora? Why do I need a rabbi many years, a few hundred years later to tell me this rule? We have an explicit Mishnah on Hayam and Aleph that we'll get to in a few weeks, which tells us Mishalshin b'mamon, ve'ein Mishalshin b'malkus, that when it comes to monetary, Adam Zomin who owe money, they're allowed to split the money. When it comes to Malkus, when it comes to lashes, they do not split lashes. So we won't get too much into the reasoning why, but basically to get less than 39 lashes is not a din malchus. Now, I think my grandfather brought up last time that there is a Gemara later on in Malkus where we say that if someone is not strong enough to receive 39 lashes, they won't get the full 39. But there has to be, it's one din. You can't split Malkus. You know, if you're supposed to get 39 lashes, your friend can't come and say, "And don't worry, a few of those lashes will be on me. I'll take them." You have to get all of the malchus. But when it comes to monetary compensation, the witnesses can split that money as long as the result is that the $200 winds up in the pocket of the defendant who they falsely accused. So the question is, that rule is an explicit Mishnah. So why do I need an Amora to come and tell me that exact rule that everybody already learned in the Mishnah earlier? It seems superfluous, unless he's coming to teach us something that we did not know already, that was not obvious from the Mishnah. A different case. Maybe he's talking about what he's coming to teach us, is that I would not have known otherwise, is let's say only one of the witnesses is convicted. So the second pair of witnesses comes in and they say, the first witness, Reuven, was with us in California at 5 o'clock p.m. on the day that you said you saw that murder or business transaction happen. But Shimon, we don't know. We don't know anything about Shimon. So they only convict Reuven of being an Eid Zomim. So Reuven would pay his $100, but Shimon would not pay $100 because Shimon was never convicted. But wait, that's not true. That's not the halacha. You can't have only one witness convicted in order to give them the status of Adam Zomimin. Adam Zomimin is literally, they have to be plural. All of the witnesses in the group. If there's three witnesses, if there's four witnesses, each and every member of that kat, of that group of witnesses, needs to be convicted as an Adam Zomimin in order for the entire kat, the entire group of witnesses, to be considered Adam Zomimin. Umimishalim Vatanya. Ainin Zomimishalim Mamon Acha Yizmushnehem. We have a brisa, which again already teaches us this rule. So Rabbi Yehuda can't be coming to tell us, he can't argue on a brisa. Brisas are taniyitic. They precede Amorayim. So I can't have an Amora many years later contradict precedent, which is found in a brisa. Amorayim cannot disagree with a Mishnah or a brisa. They can try to modify how we understood the Mishnah or brisa in the interpretation. But if a brisa says that both witnesses must be convicted, then he can't come along later and disagree and say only one witness could be convicted even. That can't work either. So now we're back to the drawing board. What is Rabbi Yehuda coming to tell us? Yes, Toby.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it seems so unfair. It seems so unfair to the person who's been falsely accused that he would have a chance to be exonerated by showing that there was an aid zoning. So you would think that they would, you know, be willing to go with even less than one, because otherwise this other person who may really not have been guilty is still presumed to be guilty.
So, okay, thank you for bringing that detail. So I should clarify that he will be exonerated, the defendant will be exonerated once one of the witnesses is invalidated. But in order to give that entire cot of witnesses, that entire group of witnesses, the special treatment of Adam Zomerman, that they will get the exact punishment that he was going to get from the court, both of them need to be found guilty. So what would happen likely is if only one of them is found guilty, he'll just get makos for being a standard aid sheker, a standard perjurious witness. But once one witness's testimony is invalid, you no longer have two witnesses, which means that the testimony falls apart and so, that person will be charged.
So to get the aggravated penalty, essentially, for the Adim Zomamin, you have to prove the conspiracy.
In order to get the special status of Adim Zomamin, both of them need to be found guilty. So they need to say both Reuven and Shimon were with us during that day in a different place at the same time, in order to get the special status of Adam Zomerman.
What were the penalties for being just a simple aid checker?
Malchus. You get rashes. What?
So it's not so different.
Well, it's different. You see, because we've been dealing, Malchus is funny. We started talking about the exceptions to the rule. But the difference is, in our case, instead of paying the defendant, they're going to get Malchus instead. They're going to get lashes. Or, I mean, this one guy would get lashes. He wouldn't be obligated to pay the defendant the amount of money that the defendant would have had to pay to the person they were claiming he had to pay to. That's the difference. Mm-hmm. But whenever you're not getting whenever you lie in court and you're proven to lie, but you're not an aid zomame, then you get 39 lashes. You get malchus. That's what we established last time. Jenny.
So, I had another question about you'd said something that you could have conspiring witnesses, you could have a group of three or a group of four, but what if only like two of the four were found to be conspiring? That seems to be enough of a group to have a conspiring witness group, but it's not the entire group that was there. Why wouldn't they still get the aid and zomamim, you know, increased punishment?
Why would they get the increased?
Why wouldn't they? Because there's enough of them to create their own group of conspiring witnesses.
Right. So if they, the truth is, if they came in as a separate groups and gave their testimony completely independent of each other, that would be the case. But once a group of people come in as one unit and give unified testimony together, now you might say if they're conspiring, they ought to be a little bit more strategic about what they're doing. And what we'll actually talk about later on in the Masechta is how having a big group could actually be a disadvantage for those who wish to give testimony. Because if one member of the group is pasul le'edus, is disqualified from giving testimony, the entire group's testimony might become inadmissible as well. So there's a bit of a question of why would you want to come in a large group? But sometimes that is the case. And if that is the case, then those are the parameters for it. Okay, but we will elaborate on bigger groups of Aden, God willing. The Gemara will talk about it in a later week.
So could you refresh my memory? Why would Malkovt be given rather than fine, paying the money?
So the reason is because we, on Amud Beis, we learned that the ninth commandment of the Ten Commandments is Losad Vareacha Eid Shaker, that you shouldn't, that there's a punishment. And then we learn from Bahayim Ben Kosar Rush, another verse, that there is Malkus for anyone who commits perjury in court. Now, there happens to be, on top of that, there's an exception to the rule, which is called Edim Zomen, which is in very special circumstances when we invalidate them because there's no way they could have made that testimony. And it's at the perfect timing after the verdict's given, but before the sentence is carried out. That's a special rule of Edim Zomen, that they get the precise punishment that they tried to impose on the defendant. But otherwise, we fall back on the default punishment of breaching the ninth commandment of the Ten Commandments, L'Slan Abrechayed Shaker, and that standard punishment is Malkus. So really, by default, it's really Malkus. Edim Zomen is really the exception to the general rule of what false witnesses get in court. Might be a better way to frame
it. It seems like it may be the more severe punishment.
So arguably, I guess it depends how you wish to frame it. Exactly. Okay.
Yeah, it depends how much you have to pay.
Right. Okay, yeah. If it was like $50, then I'd rather pay $50 than get Malkus. It was in small claims court, you're saying. Yeah, in Hachinami, that's a good point.
Yeah.
But anyway, where we left off in the Gemara was that we still don't have a case where only one witness is going to get the status of an aid zoming, right? Because if Rabbi Huda said that one witness, when he's convicted of being, he's disqualified, he's considered a sheker, gets 39 lashes, that I could live with. That would make sense. That ought to be the din. But Rabbi Yehuda said he has a status of a singular aid zomim, and he pays his portion. So where do we find a case like that? So Amar Rava, Bomer e the sheker he adati. Maybe Rava suggests a very, very nonchalantly he throws it in, but it's like a very controversial idea that someone could self-incriminate themselves as an aid zomim, as a singular aid zomim, by retracting what he said and saying, you know what? I lied, aid a sheker he adati. I committed perjury just at the right time, and Basin will charge him as an aid zomim. But the Gemara responds, there's a number of issues, but the Gemara picks this issue for some reason. Kol kimine, kevan shehigid shuveinu chozer magid. We have a rule in court that once a witness testifies, they cannot retract their testimony. Once it's given, it cannot be retracted. That is the rule when it comes to court. We don't want people changing their minds because they had a change of heart. We just want to know what the truth was. We don't want people playing around. If you could retract a testimony at any time, it diminishes the gravity and the significance of the initial testimony. When you make a testimony, you have to know this is what's being accepted. So the case that we're dealing with from Rabbi Huda can't be a case where a witness retracted. You want to retract his statement in court because you're not able to retract your state in court. That's against court proceedings. So now, okay, we're running out of options. Give me another case where there would only be one aid zome. The Gemara gives another suggestion. El ba'omer he'anuvu zamnu be'based in ploni. They suggest maybe it's when this witness, similar to now, bring in what we learned last week, he runs to a second court on his own without his co-conspirator. And he says in the second court, we were found to be Edim Zomimin in court A, and now I'm admitting to that here in court B. So that way, really, what he's saying is that I was found to be an Eid Zomim legitimately, because both me and my partner, my co-conspirator, were both found guilty of being Edim Zomimin. But only the person admitting is going to pay because only he admitted to it. He's only one person. he can't convict his co-conspirator in it. So maybe that's the case where only one witness pays as an aid zomim, because he was legitimately found to be part of aidim zomim, but he's not able to convict his co-conspirator. Now, what's the question that's bothering all of us, Jeremy?
He's committing perjury.
Okay.
In false testimony.
What was that?
He's giving false testimony in the second court because only he was found to be an aid zomim.
Well, no, but in court A, what he's reporting is that what happened in court A was me and my co-conspirator were both found guilty of being aidim zomim. So he's not, we have no reason to believe he's lying about himself. He just, as one person, doesn't have the power to convict his co-conspirator.
Somebody else already said they were both aidim zomim.
What was that?
So what difference does it make what the co-conspirator says? If this man now in the second court is reporting that they both were convicted of being aidim zomim, what difference does it make now what this guy says in the second court? They've already been validly convicted.
But the second court doesn't know what happened in the first court.
And that's my question. I've lost the thread of this. What is he doing in the second court anyway? What purpose does it serve? Why is he going to another court to even talk about the case from the first court?
Here's the scenario. The scenario is he was convicted as with his co-conspirator as Aim Zoman in court A. There must have been some sort of like riot or demonstration taking place that day. There was a lot of craziness going on. He broke out of the court, broke past security. He made a run for it. And then a few days later, Telltale Heart style, his guilt consumes him. He's already living, let's say this took place in Jerusalem. He's already up in Akko right now. And so he goes to the Beis Din in Akko and he pours out his heart and says, I committed a terrible crime back when I was living in Jerusalem. And he spills out his guts and he says, I was convicted as a group of aidim zomim. Charge me as you will. So that's what's going on over here. So the first court, he's no longer in the first court's jurisdiction. So he goes to the second court. And this is what he tells the second court. The second court has no idea what happened in the first court. They are an independent entity. That's the case over here. Does that clarify it all? I know I added a little bit of story to it, but
especially in those days where the second court wouldn't see on, I don't know, CNN what happened in the first court.
Right. There wasn't a lot of communication.
Right.
Exactly. That's why there was more minha kamakom back then, that each place developed its own customs because each place grew independently almost. Judd, I saw that you're raising your hand.
I found that what you just kind of said muddied the waters a little bit, because isn't the premise of his not receiving and not having to pay is predicated on the fact that the verdict should get in the first court, correct?
I'm sorry, the internet just jarred for a second. What do you say?
As long as the sentence has not been executed in the first court, going to the second court will absolve him of the penalty.
Because he's admitting to a penalty, right?
Right.
Ah,
but once they're found to be aidim zomim in the first court, isn't it by definition decreed? So how do you have the circumstance where he can get to the second court before sentence is established or punishment is established?
So what happened was the first court convicted them of being aidim zomim, but they didn't have a time to actually go about the procedure of sentencing them. Giving them Malkus, let's say. They said, you now are obligated to get Malkus, but then they break and make a run for it. And then he comes to the other court a year later.
In that 10-second span?
It's not 10-second span. I mean, when you think about it, we have a number of lawyers here. Someone could get a conviction, but they won't get whatever that punishment is until days later. It's not like the second the court convicts him, all of a sudden, all right, bring him out to the post. Let's whip him right away. Maybe, but they're
going to be. I'm not talking about the punishment itself, the execution of the punishment,
yeah,
just the execution of what the judgment is.
So the judgment was already made. That happened already. They were convicted. The judge gave a verdict. You are Adam Zomerman, and therefore you should get Malchus. Therefore, you should pay the defendant, whatever it is. But then they broke out and they ran away. That's what's going on here. Well, but I think, Judd, I think what you were getting to was another question, which is the next question of the Gemara. Ella, but Omer Hianufu Zanu based in Poloni. But wait a minute. Didn't we learn last week that if I admit to a knas, I admit to a penalty in court, that I'm absolved from that penalty? I think, Judd, I think that's what maybe what you were alluding to. Come on, Delo Karebi Akiva, Dekre Akiva, Amar Af Inu Mashiach Piatzmo. Wait a minute. How this case doesn't work either, because if I go to a second court and I admit to being convicted as an aid zomain, then I just absolved myself because I admitted to a penalty. And anyone who admits to a penalty is absolved from that penalty. So that doesn't make sense either. So what the Gemara needs to do is add in one little nuance, one little legal nuance here, which is different than what we learned last week. It has an additional factor than the case of Rabbi Akiva that we learned last week. We were found guilty in that other basin, and they made sure they didn't just find us guilty being Adam Zomerman, but they also handed out the verdict. They convicted us and they obligated us to pay the defendant. Last time in the Gemara, conflated it a little bit. Last week on Bays on the Bays, the witnesses were found guilty, but they were never actually taken to the next step where Basedin obligated them to pay the money. So there was like that little short piece of time over there, like Judd was mentioning. But in this case over here, Basedin already sentenced them to pay the defendant the money that they sought to convict him of. Therefore, here's an interesting legal detail here. Once Basedin imposes this penalty of Adam Zomerman on them and imposes on them to pay Ruvain money, it's no longer categorized as a knas, as a penalty. Rashi says, "Umahu shaita mamonohu gavaihu." It becomes just a regular chov. It becomes a standard monetary obligation. They basically, that money now from a legal perspective is viewed as, it's the same way as if they borrowed money from Ruvain and now they owe him $200. Once it's handed out to them, it no longer has the status of a knas. Therefore, when Ruvain goes to a second court and he admits to being an aid zomain with another guy in the previous court, and he says, Basedin obligated me to pay Ruvain $100, it's now a compensation. It's not viewed as a penalty legally at that point. Therefore, he's not admitting to a knas, to a penalty. He's admitting to just a regular chov, a regular monetary debt that he has to somebody else. I would have said, since he's the only one admitting, but his friend, his co-conspirator didn't admit to it, they're not going to be obligated. He's not going to, even he would not be obligated. Comes along Rav Yehuda in the name of Rav. Now we understand his statement, Kamash Malan. What's it mean that a single aid zomain is meshayim lefi chelko? He pays his portion. What that means is if he goes to a second court and he admits to owing someone a debt because he's an aid zomain along with somebody else, only he will pay it, but his co-conspirator won't pay because he has no right to, he can admit to his own obligation, but he can't convict his another person without having another witness. End of the Gemara over there. I realize we're only halfway down the Amud and it's 8:06. So only if there's something that's really unclear, I'll take that. But if not, we need to cover a little bit of ground. Is there anything that's like really unclear from that last part?
Yeah, this is David. It seems like something's big is missing in that. It says he's going to pay his portion, his helco. I would assume going by our previous logic that it means he's not going to pay the other guy's portion.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So what if one of them can't pay? What if it's not $50, it's $50 million?
Yeah. So what we mentioned last time on Bays and Bays is, right, so if one of them cannot pay, So if he's if the case was, let's say, they accused the defendant of theft, then it's possible it was a machlokas that the witness might be sold into indentured servitude to pay off that loan. But it's possible that if we don't hold that he can be sold as a slave to pay off that loan, then he just would get he might get malchus instead, or it would just be an outstanding obligation. You know, maybe every month he'll have to make a monthly payment to eventually pay off that obligation. So, you know, he's like financing this. He's going to have to finance it maybe from the bank. That might be the way he has to go about doing it. Okay, let's move on. For those who are with us for Friday Mishnayos, those who join us for that, we're going through Mishnayos Makos on Fridays a little bit before Shabbos. So for those who are with us for that, you'll be familiar with these Mishnayos already. The next Mishnah, this Mishnah is like the most complicated Mishnah in all of Makos. So if we make it past this Mishnah, we'll be fine for the rest of Makos. I'll do my best to explain just basic pshat. Two witnesses come in and they say that Reuven divorced his wife, he didn't pay the ksuba. When a man divorces his wife, you know how everyone, like, they get a ksuba document at their wedding, and it's very romantic. The husband hands it to his wife. They hang it, they have calligraphy. They hang it up in their dining room, wherever. The ksuba is a document that says basically what the obligations they have. And in the event that he divorces his wife or he dies first, he owes a sum of money to his wife that he leaves behind. So it's like a very much a legal document, but we romanticize it a lot. So they convict this man of divorcing his wife. Nothing, you know, he's allowed to do that, but he did not yet pay the ksuba. Whereas this man, the husband, maintains that he is actually still married to his wife, and he never divorced her, and therefore does not owe her a ksuba since he never divorced her. Then two witnesses come in. They say, you guys are Edom Zomim. This man is still married to his wife. He does not owe her a ksuba. What do the witnesses have to pay? Well, here's the thing. The thing is, there's a good chance that at some point he will have to pay her the ksuba. So there's three possibilities. Either she dies before he does, then he inherits her estate. So then he never has to pay the ksuba to her. Or the two other possibilities is he dies first, or he divorces his wife, in which case he would have to pay the ksuba. So here's the thing. They're trying to make him pay the ksuba, but it's possible someday down the line, he would have to pay that same sum of money to his wife anyway. So are they really considered to be causing him a full, you know, if the ksuba, let's say, is worth, I'm just making up the amount of money now, $1,000, that they are causing him to lose $1,000, he might have to pay that $1,000 to his wife down the line anyway. So that's not a sure loss that he has here. It's different than the other case we dealt with where you say, you owe Reuven $200. And I would not be paying $200 to my friend Reuven had you not convicted me otherwise. But this man may very well have to pay his wife at some point. So how do we evaluate what they're making him lose? How do we evaluate this chance? So the Mishnah says this is how we evaluate it. And I'm just going to kind of translate the Mishnah, but the Gemara is going to tell us what the Mishnah really means. The Mishnah doesn't mean what it sounds like I'm about to say, which I know that sounds very confusing. Omdin kama adam rotsli tein b'ksuba. So we evaluate how much, let's say I'm an investor. I want to invest in the chance of me getting the ksuba. So how much would a person invest in the ksuba of the woman, shalzu, shim nisalma niskarsha, on the chance that she is divorced or she's widowed or divorced, then mesa yirshena baila. But then at the same time, there's a risk that her husband is going to inherit her estate. So here is how we evaluate it. Three opinions in the Gemara. You see, it's a very short piece of Gemara, but it's only 2.5 lines. But if you look at Rashi, like Rashi is half the page over here, all on these few lines of Gemara. So I did my best. I'm going to do my best to just summarize what's going on here. There are three ways to evaluate what this means. Ketzad Shaman, how do we evaluate how much the witnesses owe the husband? Amar v'chista bibal. We evaluate based on what they are making the husband lose. What does that mean? So when a man owes, when a man has to give, now let me rephrase that. There is a lien on one of the husband's fields. The ksuba causes a lien on a field. There's a field designated that if he doesn't have the cash, the ksuba will be taken from selling this field. That's what the lien is. But meanwhile, before that ksuba ever has to be given, in that eventuality, the husband is still allowed to benefit from the fruits of that field. He's allowed to eat from that field, utilize that field however he likes, until which point the ksuba might need to be collected from that field. So the way we evaluate the loss is how much would someone invest in the husband's chance of keeping the ksuba, but B, an additional factor in there is that he gets the benefit from the field that the lien of the ksuba is on currently. How much would an investor pay for immediate gratification, immediate benefit from the field with the lien, and the chance that the man will be able to retain the ksuba? However much an investor would pay for that chance and that immediate benefit, that's how much the witnesses owe to the husband, because that's what they tried to cause him to lose. They tried to make him lose the benefit from the field that he has currently and from the chance of retaining the ksuba over time. That is the first way to evaluate it. The second way the Gemara suggests to evaluate it, Rav Nosson Bar Oshia Omer Be'isha, we evaluate it from the woman's standpoint. Now, what does it mean from the woman's standpoint? What it means basically is how much would an investor pay for the chance that he could take the ksuba with the chance if the woman were to be widowed or divorced. So let's say it's $400. So then what we do is if the ksuba is worth $1,000 and a person would be willing to invest $400 on the chance that she were to get the ksuba, he would get it instead. We deduct that $400 from the total worth of the ksuba, $1,000, the sum total, minus $400, which is considered like the woman's immediate portion of the ksuba. And we're left with $600, which is the husband's portion of the ksuba. Apparently, Rashi says if you crunch the numbers, the Edom will actually pay more money than if we were to evaluate it the first way. If someone wants to sit down with the numbers and go ahead and crunching all of it, you can let me know, but I'll take Rashi's word for it. Numbers are not my forte. But then the third and final suggestion the Gemara of how to evaluate this is similar to the one we just said, just with one added detail. Amar Rav Papa Be'isha B'Ksubasa, based on a woman, but strictly based on her ksuba. So a little bit of detail. When a woman enters a marriage, she has a dowry in the dunya. The dowry is called Nichsei Tzon Barzel. She brings in a certain property into the marriage that when she leaves the marriage, if that property is worth $1,000 on the way in, that $1,000 is added to the total amount of the ksuba, and the husband owes her that money on top of the original base amount of money in the ksuba on her way out. But then there's something called Nichsei Malug, which is not part of the dowry, but it's just property she happens to own when she gets married to her husband. So Nichsei Milug is considered still within the ownership of full ownership of the woman, but the man, the husband, is allowed to benefit from the English term is usufruct, from the peiros, the fruits that are literally the fruits that are produced by that field. So what he's telling us is don't take the Nichsei Milug into account. Because I would say the witnesses are not only causing the man to possibly lose the ksuba, but he's also losing the benefit of gaining fruit from the property that his wife happens to bring into the marriage. What the third opinion of Nosson Bar Oshia is coming to tell us is don't take the secondary property into account. Rather, only look at the strict worth of the ksuba, and then deduct the wife's portion from there, and that's how you evaluate how much the husband is supposed, how much the husband's portion is worth an investor. And that is how much the witnesses were considered to be trying to cause him a loss. And that's how much they owe him. Those are the three ways to evaluate it. I sat down for a considerably long amount of time trying to wrap my head around it and make sure I understood all three ways. There is so much layers upon layers of discussion on this. And frankly, if we just understand the basic ideas of evaluation, then I think we just conquered what I consider probably to be the most complicated few lines in all of Makos. So the good news is, I think it only gets smoother from here on out. So we can breathe a sigh of relief. If you understood all that and that was easy for you, then the rest of Makos hopefully should fly by pretty well. If that was difficult, don't worry. The rest of Makos should be hopefully easier than that. All right?
Can you hear me?
Yes, Sadie.
Okay. I got some problems. Why isn't this one of the few cases where a woman can testify in a Beis Din? And what I'm thinking is, if she's really divorced, she can come to court with her get, because without a get, there's no divorce, if I understand correctly. Or she could come to the court and say, we're still married. And so, it seems to me that, that when the husband and the wife are both saying they're still married, that ought to overcome the witnesses.
Excellent. So thank you. So I need to fill in a little detail. Of course, if the woman says, I'm still married and my husband doesn't owe me a ksuba, then the defendant would never have to pay the ksuba. So we're assuming that that the woman, again, is kind of, maybe she's conspiring with the witnesses possibly. But number two, the other point that you made, what was the first point?
That she come to court with the ksuba.
With the get. So right, obviously there's no get here. If she came with the get, that would be proof right over there. That'd be proof that she was divorced. So we're assuming that the get is nowhere to be seen as well. If the get had witnesses signed on it, or if there are witnesses that saw it being given, then that would probably constitute proof. So I think we are assuming that there's no other proof other than these two witnesses. It's two witnesses' word versus the husband's word. We take the two witnesses' word as binding in court. So, right, I needed to fill in those details, so I appreciate you making sure I did that.
Shouldn't the court compel her to come in and testify?
Well, I think one has to understand that she is with the witnesses on this. So I think she is on the witnesses' side over here. That's my understanding.
Okay. And then the next thing that I have is, we're assuming this guy is a farmer and therefore he has fields. What if he's a shopkeeper in Yerushalayim or Akko?
The lien would have to go on something. It might not go right. Would it go strictly on a field? Would it go on his home? Right. I'm not exactly sure what the lien would go on per se. But okay. So that's a good question as well. That's something for me to look up. But something that would be, have a status that's similar to karka, something like that. But not metaltlin, what's the legal translation for metaltlin? Movable objects? What's the legal term for all of our lawyers here? Chattel? Something like that? Chattel? Is that the word? Chattel, okay. I remember, it always sounds like cattle. Chattel. Metaltlin.
There's real property and there's personal property. Chattels are personal property, or the other way around.
So that's the chasim she'ina mishubadin. There's a chasim mishubadin, property that can have a lien on. So, okay, that's a good point. We'll leave it as is for now. We have about 10 minutes to just get the last piece of Gemara in, so I want to make sure we cover that. And if there are any remaining questions, I'll try to stay on after 8:30, but I don't want to keep people past an hour. So let's go to the next Mishnah. The good news is the next Mishnah is, as I said, the best is yet to come. It only gets easier from here on out. So, Me'ida anu b'ish ploni shu chayv l'chaveru elef zuz. Almanas litain litnin lo mikan bad shloshim yom. The two witnesses come in, they say, Ruvain owes Shimon whatever the sum of money is, a thousand zuz, $1,000, and has to be paid within 30 days. Behu omer, But the defendant says, no, mikadavad eser shanim. For I have 10 years to pay off that loan, much longer amount of time than what the witnesses are saying. So when the witnesses are ultimately found to be guilty, it's a similar question to what we had with the ksuba, that this person does owe Shimon 1,000 zuz. He just doesn't owe it for another 9 years and 11 months. So again, the witnesses aren't causing him an outright loss, because that is going to be lost. He will have to pay 1,000 zuz at some point. So how do we evaluate how much they're causing him to lose by pushing up the payment date to 1 month from 10 years? So it actually seems pretty logical. Omdim kama adam rotzli tevi yubiyada av zuz bein nosim mikava lamayom bein nosim mikava eser shanim. We would ask an investor, We ask the defendant, how much would you pay to extend this loan meaning how much interest? So here's the thing. Interest is bad. Interest is usur. It's prohibited. But in theory, if interest were permissible, how much interest would you be willing to pay in order to get an extension on your loan from 30 days to 10 years? However much interest he in theory would be willing to pay to extend the loan from 30 days to 10 years, that is how much the witnesses were intending to cause him to lose, to cause him to pay. That's the loss that they were causing him. That's how much money the witnesses, Adam Zoman, would have to pay the defendant. Does that make sense?
I got one problem with it. 30 years is going to interfere with the 10 years. And that would be released.
What's going to interfere?
The Shemitah year.
Frek Zedi Akasha. So Shemitah, we're going to have the sabbatical year that's going to come into conflict. Very good. And that's precisely the question of the Gemara. So, you know, Zedi, you could have been an Amora. You can think exactly like them. So the Gemara's question is going to be as follows. We know that every 7 years is a Shemitah year. Now, many times when we think of Shemitah, we think of resting of the land, Shemitah's karka, that all the fruits in people's fields become hefker, they become free. You shall not work the land of Israel for the entire seventh year. It's a sabbatical year, and that is all true. But there's another halacha that people know a little bit less about. It's a little bit less commonly known, called Shemitah's ksufim, that if I owe you money, and I owe you $100, and then the Shemitah year comes year seven in the cycle, that loan is also mishtamet. It also dissipates, and I no longer owe you any money that I previously owed you. So the issue over here to my grandfather, and turns out the Gemara raises as well, is that by the time 10 years are up, I wouldn't have to pay any money. The defendant wouldn't have to pay any money at all. So they're not really, the witnesses aren't just causing him a loss, like a little loss by decreasing the amount of time he has to pay back. But really, they should have to pay all the money, because had it been 10 years, instead of 30 days, he would never have to pay back at all. That's what would have happened. So that's precisely the question of the Gemara. So let's take a look in the Gemara over here, and we'll see that question play out momentarily. Amar Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Hamalve Eschaveir LeEtzer Shanim, someone who lends to his friend for 10 years, Shvius Misham Tasso, Shvius will cancel that loan, will cancel the debt, rather. V'Avla Gav DeHatcha Lo Karina Be Lo Yigos, so Lo Yigos is the obligation in the verse that the person. So you might be tempted on year seven to try to collect the loan anyway, but comes along and turns this low yigos. You shouldn't bother. You shouldn't harass the person who's indebted to you to pay back that money. So even though when year seven comes along in the cycle, year seven, he still doesn't owe you the money yet. So maybe I would say Shemitah would not cancel a loan because he doesn't pay you in that year anyway. So if asi l'day low yigos. Since in the end of the day, at some point after the seventh year, he's going to owe you the money. Once you hit year seven cancels the loan. So it's not really a 10-year loan. It's an effect. In effect, what happens is there's really no debt at all. He basically just gave you the money for free. So Musiv Rav Kahana, and that's Rav Kahana's question on our Mishnah. Our Mishnah said, Omdim kama adar motzli tev yu elef zuz biyado, beinli tev mikam v'alam yom, beinli tev mikam v'adeser shanim. Our Mishnah said, we had just assessed the witnesses are only causing him to lose however much he would have paid to extend the loan, but they're not causing to lose the entire debt. V'yamrit shviyas mishan taso, kunami boy shlumele. If shviyas were to cancel the loan, really by decreasing the amount of time he has from 10 years to 30 days, they're really causing him to pay the entire debt now. They owe him for the entire debt, not just for the extension. So how does our Mishnah fit with this statement? That's what doesn't make sense. So that was the question that we just raised. And I'll just finish this piece of Gemara so we can finish it before 8:30, and then I'll take questions. Amar Rava, Hacha b'mayaskinan, what are we dealing with here in this case? What happened in the case of the Mishnah? So here's the thing. Our Mishnah is an exception to the rule. The rule is Shvius, seventh year, cancels alone, period. But our Mishnah is an exception to the rule. Our Mishnah has a unique factor that we didn't take into the equation. We're talking about either a case of a Malva Amashkon, where there was a collateral taken, or a Moser Sharos of the Basedin, or he gave a principal, he appointed Basedin, the Jewish court system, to collect the loan for him. The Tanan, as we learn in the Mishnah in Maseches Shviyas, Hamalve al Hamashkon, by Moser Sharos of the Basedin, in Mashmitin. If one either takes a collateral, we learned this in our Sunday morning class a long time ago, in the Chumash class, if someone loans on a collateral or does a prosbol, we'll elaborate on it a little bit more next time, then they actually are able to get their full money back, because either if he has a collateral, it's considered to a certain extent as if he collected the money already because he has the collateral to collect from, or B, if Basedin's collecting on his behalf, then he's not violating the prohibition of lo yigos, of harassing the lova, the borrower, for the money back. It's Basedin doing it. Therefore, Basedin is able to extract the money on his behalf. So our Mishnah is dealing with this case where he either did a prosbul or took out a collateral. Therefore, Shvius would not cancel the loan. And therefore, the Adim Zomimin are really just causing to lose the extension on the loan, but they're not causing him to have to pay the entire debt altogether that he would have to pay in any event. That brings us to the end of the Gemara that we are doing for today on Gimel Amud Beis. And the good news is, if we rush a little bit faster this last section, the next piece of Gemara we'll pick up with next time is a restatement of everything we just said in a different style. So I will open up next week's class by rehashing on these details. But that being said, it's 8:30. The class is officially ended. Anyone needs to go? It was wonderful learning with all. You have a wonderful Shabbos. And I'll stay on for another few minutes if anyone has any questions that I can address.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right.
I am so confused. I have to tell you the truth. I am so confused.
On this last part or on everything?
Toby, I'm with you.
Yeah, no, just like the whole loan thing. I was okay with the ksuva.
Okay.
But this loan thing just has me, because I'm...
No, I'm still back on the, I confess that I was in... Zomimim, and I don't have to pay, but he has to pay, and he has to pay, but I don't have to pay. That last little bit I didn't get.
Well, if you have a moment, I'm happy to stay on and try to clarify it. So if there's any specific section you want to go through, but if you feel like you're ready to log out for the night, that's also fine. So I'm here to go back to that if you like. Is that of interest?
Yeah, I mean, Howard just asked the question that is driving me crazy. Clearly in the Jewish legal system, you can't have a 10-year loan. So why are they talking about a 10-year loan?
Ah, okay. Right. So that question that you're bothered by and Howard's bothered by is the question of the Gemara. That is the question in the Gemara. So it's a good thing you're bothered by that, because that's what the Gemara is bothered by.
Just to clarify how Shemitah works.
Yes.
If I've given a loan and I definitely owe the money, but the time didn't come due yet, then the loan is just canceled and I never have to pay it back?
Yes.
Ever, ever, ever.
Ever, ever.
Hence the Prusball concept.
Right. And that's, as Henry said, that's why people actually didn't, you know, we'll talk about this next time, God willing, but the background is that people, because of this, I mean, it seems absurd. You know, you're bothered by this idea, and you weren't only bothered by it, but people back in the times of the Mishnah and Talmud were bothered. In fact, people stopped giving out long-term loans to those who were in need because they said, well, if I give you a loan and next year's a Shemitah year, I'm never going to see this money ever again. So it became a huge issue that no one ever wanted to give a loan anymore. So Hillel said, you know what? This is untenable. No one is giving loans to those who are in need of money. So then he instituted a Prusbul, which was a legal loophole of sorts, that if you submit this loan to Beis Din, to the Jewish court, the court collects instead of you collecting. The prohibition in the verse is that lo yigos, that the malve, the lender, is not allowed to collect from the love. But if the Beis Din comes and collects, then that's not a violation, and they would be able to collect that loan. So that's and that's the case of our Mishnah. We must assume that the case of our Mishnah is a case like a Prusbul, where there was a Prusbul, so the loan will be in effect even during Shemitah year, and that's why the witnesses don't owe the full amount of money to the person that they said only owed it within 30 days. Does that give some background at all? I do hope to open with precisely this conversation next, because the next section of Gemara is an Ibais Ema, which is the same content but just states the conversation in a different order. So I'm actually going to give a little background beginning of next time as well. So hopefully that'll help.
We actually got a little bit onto B, right?
Yeah, because there was no good ending point at the beginning. So we made a little progress. So it should go by faster next time as well. Or I'll just have more time, I guess. All right. Sarah, was there anything you said earlier?
Yeah, I understood the ketubah part. That was fine with me. That part didn't bother me. It was way back before where we were talking about Rava and what he said. I got the whole thing about why, you know, it couldn't be divided and even though I lied and all that. But then we got to the two guys and we were trying to split them up and he confesses,
mm-hmm.
right? And so in the end, which one of them pays? The one that confesses or the one that doesn't confess?
The one that confesses. Because I, you know, logically, I can admit to owing somebody money. I can't volunteer my friend to pay somebody else money. So that's what Rav Yehuda Amar Rav's statement was at the beginning of the Gemara. Where's the case of an Eid Zomein paying half the amount when he admits to being found guilty with the other guy previously? But he doesn't have the right to convict his co-conspirator, but he has a right.
Why doesn't the first court still have the right?
So they do. If the first court can extradite them and can get them back into the first court, the Ketzos HaChoshen says, could still charge him. It's just we're dealing with a case where, you know, he's halfway around the world. We don't have a network of police to extradite him. And this is a separate entity.
But wait, if already you're calling them Adim Zomamim,
mm-hmm.
then they have been convicted. That's a conclusion. It's not, in other words, you're not an Eid Zomim just by being accused. You're an Eid Zomim if the other two witnesses come and testify, right? So your status is solidified as punishable already.
Exactly.
So why couldn't the first court still punish the guy that's within his jurisdiction?
Oh,
and the second court punish the one who's in the other jurisdiction so that they both end up getting their just punishment.
You're correct. That could happen, but the case assumes that both witnesses fled the jurisdiction of the first court. That first witness disappeared for good.
Oh, they both fled.
They both fled.
They both fled. Okay. Okay.
I thought it was that they were both found guilty. They were both told you owe, and then they fled.
They were both found guilty. Wait, just remember.
Told they were aiding Zomamim. You have to pay. And then they fled, and Reuven said, I got to get out of this. And so he went to the second court and said, I confess.
Yes. That is the case.
So why did he go to the second court?
Because this, you know, imagine like, what was that?
If he still has to pay, he didn't accomplish anything by going to the second
court. I thought he was going to the second court to get out of it.
No, he's going to the second court to do tshuva. He's admitting his past deed that he escaped from that first court. He's admitting that I was a terrible person. I still owe that money. And I'm asking you to make sure that that happens.
Wait, but if he was still in front of the first court, would he be paying money or he'd be getting malkot?
If he was still in front of the first court, then he'd also be paying the money. He's because both him and the co-conspirator. So if what happened was one of them ran away from the first court, but the first guy was still, but the other guy was still there. Since they were him and his partner were both found to be Adam Zomerman, the first guy would have to pay. Whoever's there would still have to pay. So as long as the first court, whoever they could get their hands on, once both witnesses were found together to be a group of Adam Zomerman, whoever they could get their hands on from that group, they will mete out that punishment, and they will make sure that it's carried out and that they pay whatever they owe.
So really the only reason someone's not paying is because they ran away. It has nothing to do with what court they're in or whose court they're in. Only reason someone's not paying is because they ran away.
Only reason they're not paying, exactly. Because so that's the only
like a good idea to run away. I mean, it doesn't seem to give it, you would think the system would try to incentivize staying in the system and taking your punishment. And instead it's totally rewarding
running away.
Why? Who?
Interesting.
Okay, interesting. Now I understand. Now I got it.
There is a difference between
they do tshuva.
There's right. No reward for doing tshuva aside from doing tshuva, the obvious rewards of doing tshuva. But according, like this whole discussion doesn't help with anything.
Doesn't help with anything. Well, the goal of the discussion really was that. Rav Yehuda made a statement, Eid Zomeim Ashan Lefi Chalko, that a witness, an Eid Zomeim, a singular Eid Zomeim, pays his portion. And the entire Gemara revolved around just trying to make sense of what he was saying, because either what he was saying was stated before him in a Mishnah or a Braisa already, or what we thought he was saying did not hold up, was not true in Halacha. So we needed to find something that was novel, but also acceptable in Halacha. And that's why we came to this really odd case, and that had to be what he was saying.
Now, one thing I'm not certain of, are we talking about where the witness runs in between being found guilty and before he's been sentenced or after he's been sentenced?
So here, in this case, is after he was sentenced, and that's why the money is no longer viewed as a penalty, but as a debt to the defendant. And that's why when he admits to the crime, he could still be charged to pay the defendant. He's admitting to a chov, to a debt. He's not admitting to a knas, to a penalty.
But why couldn't it be that Reuven and Shimon were found to be Enim Zomim, but they didn't have the sentence yet? Mm-hmm. Reuven runs to Akko and confesses, right? So it's a penalty in that case. So he doesn't have to pay. But then Shimon, the sentence is given, so he has to pay.
Shimon, that seems possible.
So then he is only one that has to pay.
Oh, that's a good question.
I've solved the whole problem.
Wow.
There you go, you see?
That's a great alternative. You know what? If I do a little research, I wouldn't be surprised if any of the Rishonim suggest something like that. That sounds like a very good approach.
The whole problem is solved, and it's none of this. I don't know. It just makes more sense to me.
Well, I get to the second court to say one guy ran away and they're just extracting the money from the first guy.
Right. This way, one runs away. It's a penalty. So he's excused. Hmm. And the other one gets the sentence and he does have to pay.
That's a great question, Sarah. And yeah.
Probably missing something.
I got to be missing something because it can't be that easy.
Well, if you're missing something, I'm missing something also, because I think that's a great point. So we'll be missing that together. But what I can say is there's really two things. I think at this point, we understand Pshat in the Gemara. Now, we might have a question on our understanding of the Gemara, but we understand the Gemara now.
Yes.
So that's good. That's good. We can have kashas. We can have questions on the Gemara that we won't necessarily resolve all of them, but we do understand the Gemara. So that's good.
That makes me feel good.
Okay, thank good. You. You know, you understood enough that you could ask a good kasha on the Gemara as well. So that's important. All right. Yasher Kalach, everyone. Thank you all
thank
for staying
you.
On.
Good night.
To clarify, and have a great Shabbos.
Thank you. Good Shabbos. Good Shabbos, everybody.